of prayer and self-denial has been for you as you've thought about and prayed for those of our wider Baptist family who are serving God in places overseas. How has that impacted you in the context that you're in? And how has that, our reflection on modern idolatry last week, impacted the way you see your world? After last week, as I've thought a little bit more about how easy it is to let idols and things that distract us from worshipping God, as I've noticed that more and more, I've also been asking God to open my eyes to see God's activity in the neighbourhood particularly. But to be honest, it's still really easy to let distractions override my desire to pray for or my seeking of God's presence and activity. But there have been a couple of things this week that I have noticed that I might not have been had we not thought about idolatry last week. The first was the number of people who were out and about just simply caring for others. I saw someone who was guiding, a couple of people actually guiding people who were blind or are blind. I saw others taking people with Down syndrome for a walk just around the neighbourhood, and it was really wonderful the way that the person was just really caring for these two people who probably wouldn't have been able to do that just out and about by themselves. And I was struck by both the vulnerability that is within our community, but also the wonderful way that God's love is being shared and expressed to those people, whether their carers are acknowledging that or whether they themselves are acknowledging that themselves or not. But the most significant experience this week for me, however, was along with Nathan and Mel from the Presbyterian Church, we were invited to a meeting with three other people from the Island Bay community, none of whom share our faith in Jesus, but they wanted to bring us together to discuss how we can bridge the increasingly toxic divide in our community about the cycleway. The churches were being invited by people of no or other faith perspectives who are concerned about the significant divide that this is in our community. They're being invited into that space. We, the churches, are being invited into that space to be agents of reconciliation. Now, none of us were naive enough to think that that was something that was going to be a quick or easy fix, but I was deeply impacted by the unity that was around that table with very different perspectives, because we have a common desire for the good of this community. This is God at work. This is the light of God already at work in our neighborhood, working towards reconciliation. I admit, my gut reaction to that meeting, though, was it would be easier to resolve some of the theological hot-button topics in the church than this particular issue. But God is capable of doing things far beyond my own expectations. And God is working, even when we can't see it or aren't looking for evidence of that work. Which is one of the curious things about the story of Esther. I'm just going to get my phone so I can switch the slides. God isn't mentioned in Esther, in the book of Esther, once. God is implied, but not named. Now, we can assume, of course, that God is working behind the scenes, but the agents of God's work were people willing to get involved on the front lines. And that's the theme of this week, frontline faithfulness, the Esther era. Sorry, just get this. Hopefully I'll be able to do that. Excellent, thank you. So after considering Haman's self-entitlement and greed last week, we're shifting our focus to someone who until this point in the story had not enjoyed really any agency or power. She was not someone who would have been an obvious choice for God to use to bring about God's purposes even after she became queen. But that's what happens. She chooses to join the front lines and be faithful to her people. So I'm going to read Esther chapter 4, and as I'm reading it, what do you notice about Esther's attitudes and behavior that show her frontline faithfulness? This is Esther chapter 4, hopefully. You might just have to listen to my dulcet tones. Thanks, Red, sorry. So Esther 4. Not coming up? I'll go for it. stand by. Please hold caller. Your call is important to us. I'll just read. Thanks, Fred. When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it to it. In every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. That edict is the one that the Jews are all going to get killed on a particular day. That's what that's referring to from chapter 3. When Esther's eunuchs and female attendants came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show to Esther and explain it to her. And he told him to instruct her to go into the king's presence to beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. Hathach went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, "All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that they be put to death, unless the king extends the gold scepter to them and spares their life, their lives. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king." When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer: "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your family's father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this." Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai: "Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. I wonder, what did you notice about Esther's frontline faithfulness towards the issues that she and her people were facing? There are a few things that I'll reflect on briefly that I've noticed. First, upon hearing the news of Mordecai's, her cousin and the person that raised her after she was orphaned, about his grief, I noticed the way the text says she was in great distress. At this point, she didn't know what was going on, what the problem was, and so certainly wasn't thinking about a solution. But she knew of the suffering of someone she loved. And I think of the times that I have felt distressed for people that I love and know how overwhelming that feeling can be at times. Finding solutions or acting quickly in those kinds of situations is not my forte, especially when there is nothing really that can be done other than being present in someone's grief. And Esther wasn't even able to do that. This man's grief was being expressed extremely publicly in a way that was inspiring the rest of her people in the city to do the same. They were all in sackcloth and ashes, it says. And Esther could not be present with her people because of the fact that she had been forced to become queen. She saw great suffering and would have been excused, I think, for feeling overwhelmed and helpless. In the face of the great suffering in our world, it's easy to get overwhelmed as well, I think. Knowing that, and especially in those bigger issues, there's nothing that I can do about it. Even us as a community, there's nothing we can do about it. We hear of we hear of wars and insurrections, and we know of the innocent victims of the violence of those things. There are famines, natural disasters, human trafficking, racial injustice, child poverty, and sexual violence. There seems to be no end to the great distress in our world. And it is overwhelming when we stop to think about it, and can be hard to see where God's reconciling light is. And to be honest, it all seems too big to do anything about. But Esther's distress and her possible feelings of being overwhelmed did not prevent her from acting. She did what she could. She sent people initially to find out what was going on. And after a couple of attempts, she finds out about Haman's plot to destroy the Jews around the Persian Empire. An ethnic cleansing, like what we're seeing in Myanmar at the moment. Her distress did not prevent action. However, her humanity in that moment is evident as well. And that's the next thing I noticed. When she heard about what had happened and heard what Mordecai was suggesting that she does, she didn't jump straight on to the front line. Her response was to say, hold on a second, if I do what you're asking me to do, I'm probably going to die. Initially, it sounds simple, a simple request. Go and talk to your husband about this. Get him to reverse the edict. But she was honest about her legitimate reservations about what that was going to could require of her. She highlights that either way, her life is at risk, whether the edict continues or whether she goes and is not, doesn't have that scepter extended to her. Her life is at risk. The need was great, and so were the risks. And I think it's natural for us to have reservations when we see possible solutions, to ask questions, is there a better way of doing this, a less risky way of doing this, a less risky way of getting involved in God's work. But I love that quote from the video that the narrator says, mission is risky, but not all risk is bad. Risk requires us to put our faith, to put our trust, he said, in the Lord. And I've spoken to a number of people, as I imagine many of us have, who have spent time in risky mission situations, whether they be people living in communities that most of us would not want to go anywhere near, or going to a place overseas where political and social upheaval due to war or dictatorships or religious persecution is a part of daily life. And for each of those conversations, no matter how strong the call of God was or is on their life, they still have questions. They still have reservations. They still wonder about safety. They think about the things they're sacrificing, and they think about the risk that they are taking. When we think about mission, we need to acknowledge the risks and sacrifices that are required of us. And for most of us, mission will be here at home. And in conversations that I've had with some, not here so much, but and others with other people, it sometimes feels like going overseas is a little bit easier than engaging in mission in New Zealand. At least over there, it seems like there's a tangible difference being made. But mission starts with where the need is that we are aware of. Like Esther, what or whose grief do we see that makes us want to act? What ways can we respond in those moments? How can we honestly express our reservations about that? We might not be risking life and limb, but it is potentially reducing our earning capacity, our status, or our reputation, or it might just risk ridicule. None of these things are the things that we should just shrug off, of course, as if they don't matter. But equally, they could become modern idols which distract us from what God is calling us to do. Mission is risky, but not all risk is bad. Risk requires us to place our trust in the Lord. After Esther acknowledged her reservations, she then chooses to fast and encourages all of her people in that city to do the same. She engaged in a spiritual practice to prepare herself, to enable her to lead well in those moments, enable to prepare herself to lead and to take that next step of risk to go to the king. And imagine the feeling of knowing her whole community around that city is doing the same thing with her. So I wonder what are our common spiritual practices that we could carry out as a community. We, of course, have our Sunday morning gatherings and our prayer spaces throughout the weeks. But how can we participate in more spiritual practices that we're all doing, maybe at the same time, maybe not, but having a common experience as we prepare and as we continue to take steps? Imagine doing something together throughout the week, even if it is in our own homes, and then telling stories together of what God is doing and saying to us in those moments. That common spiritual practice, having acknowledged the risk of mission. And then, of course, finally, Esther puts herself in harm's way for the good of her people. She took the risk. She approached the king. And there's an interesting dynamic in what Mordecai says to her when he says, effectively, if you don't do this, someone else is going to deliver us anyway. And if you don't do it, you're probably going to die anyway. Now, Esther's motivation, I don't think, is selfish, but her response is inextricably linked to her people, the people that she is committed to. And I wonder if mission in a New Zealand context feels a bit harder because we don't see ourselves maybe connected to those we are trying to point to Jesus. I think there's a challenge to the individualistic focus of the gospel that is often prevalent in the Western church. I'm not a cyclist. I don't have a bike. But I was horrified to hear that after a mother and their child was knocked off their bike recently on the parade, not too long after that, another driver drove past, wound down their window, and hurled abuse at them. That's not the kind of community I want to be a part of. I don't want that happening in our community. And it has nothing to do with what I think or don't think about the cycleway. The way our community treats particularly vulnerable people, like women and children who have just been knocked off their bike, is indicative of the values that drive us as a community. And what if we saw our faith communities flourishing as tied to that of the wider community flourishing? What are we doing, or what are we willing to do, that is going to protect those who are vulnerable? And how can we be people who are building bridges between people who are so divided? Gospel renewal in our community starts with those of us who follow Jesus. Esther acknowledged that need, even as she was distressed by it. She acknowledged her reservations about her part in the solution. And we can all think of reservations about about getting involved in that particular conflict in our community. But she engaged also in the life-giving spiritual practices communally, and then committed to doing what it took at great risk to herself. She was faithful on the front lines. How can we as a faith community here, gathered by Christ, do the same? I'm going to pray. Jesus, you are calling us as your people to engage in the risk of sharing your love and your light with this world. You modeled that for us as you came to this world. Would you give each of us and us communally more courage and more awareness of the things that we can be doing as we partner with you in your reconciling work? In your name we pray. Amen. spend some time reflecting again.